Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Once again, Black women had a huge part in electing a Democratic candidate for president.
Senator Harris stands in for Black women who today, in a short 55 years, have made themselves a force in American politics.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Monday, November 9th, the power of the Black woman vote. Also, President-elect Biden ran his campaign claiming to unify the country, and his first speech to the nation echoed that message.
And to make progress, we have to stop treating our opponents as our enemies. They are not our enemies. They are Americans.
But will he be successful? Plus, President Trump hasn't conceded and is banking on far-fetched legal challenges.
This gives him an off-ramp. He can say, okay, well, I'll leave the White House on January 20th if you make me, but I don't believe that I really lost this election.
But first,
I had to run here and celebrate with everyone, man. I have no words.
I was teaching a class and I started crying. I heard cheering outside and I could hear it inside. And I was like, I think Biden won. And I grabbed my phone and checked and it was just really exciting and I was crying.
My mother is a disabled woman who's on Social Security and Medicaid and Medicare. And to know that Donald Trump is out and he can no longer mess with those programs is amazing.
We have to include everyone. We need a government of inclusion for the people and by the people.
I'm feeling most hopeful about people caring about other people. And that to me is the most important thing in our existence.
Estamos bien felices.
It's historical. And sometimes hysterical.
This is a moment right now of victory and we're celebrating and taking the streets. But it's not enough. Our work doesn't end here. Now we have to make sure that these promises are delivered to our community.
This day means victory. This day means Black Lives Matter. This day means the next generation. This day means hope. This day means integrity. This day means consistency. This day means that nobody's going to tell us and talk to us and say that it's jokes. No, we're not going to get fake news anymore. We're not going to get the wrong answers. That's what this day means. So this day means music. This day means we can open our mouths and feel happy and walk down these streets and feel comfortable as young African American and mixed children. That's what this day means to us.
A historic election week followed by an emotional weekend as Joe Biden was called the winner of the 2020 election, along with running mate Kamala Harris, the first woman, the first Black woman, the first South Asian woman elected to the executive branch. Black women have long been the backbone of the Democratic Party, and this year is no different. Exit polls are showing that more than 90% of Black women cast their ballots for the Democratic ticket. With slim margins in a number of battleground states like Georgia and Pennsylvania, Black voters, especially Black women, helped propel Biden and Harris to victory over President Trump. For more on the power of Black women at the ballot box, I'm joined now by Kimberly Peeler Allen, visiting practitioner at the Rutgers University Center for American Women in Politics. Politics, and Martha Jones, a professor from the Johns Hopkins University and author of Vanguard, How Black Women Broke Barriers, Won the Vote, and Insisted on Equality for All. Kimberly and Martha, thanks for joining us.
So great to be here.
Martha, this isn't new. Once again, Black women have led the way for the Democratic Party. How did they become the most consistent Democratic voter bloc in United States history?
Black women have for 100 years, since ratification of the 19th Amendment, been organizing, strategizing, defying the odds, and insisting on a place at the table in American politics. Black women spend until 1965, too many of them disenfranchised until passage of the Voting Rights Act. And so when we see Senator Harris stands in for Black women who today, in a short 55 years have made themselves a force in American politics.
What motivated Black women to the polls this year in particular?
Well, I think what motivated them this year is very similar to what has motivated them to the polls ever since they got the franchise. And it was, I think, particularly salient this year Black lives were on the ballot. We were looking at equity. We were looking at inclusion. We were looking at our personal safety. We were looking at the discord and the language that was being levied against Black and brown people from the White House. And I think that was a huge contributing factor, as well as what has been happening with COVID and how it has taken a disproportionate number of Black lives because of this virus and how it has been managed. And between that and education, and there was just so many issues that brought Black women to the polls. But we also, you know, saw that it was our role to step up to protect our democracy and make sure that all of our voices and that were heard and that everyone had an equal chance to not just survive but truly thrive in this country. And in order for that to happen, we felt that it needed to be a change in the administration.
If you are listening to our segment and you yourself are a Black woman or a Black American voter and you want to tell us your thoughts about this historic election, give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Martha, Kamala Harris has regularly paid tribute to Black women who have come before her, like civil rights activist Fannie Lou Hamer and Ida B. Wells and so many others. Were there echoes of these women during this election cycle?
Absolutely. And thank you to Senator Harris for giving the nation a lesson in Black women's political history, because you're right. She has at every opportunity at the podium reminded us of the legacy of women like Fannie Lou Hamer, like Ida B. Wells, and so many others. I think one of the things that we see in Senator Harris that is so characteristic of this legacy is her broad, broad vision. In addition to all of the issues that Kimberly has so importantly laid out, Black women have characteristically, over the course of more than a century, held up the very notion of democracy, the very ideals, right, that undergird this nation, not only for Black Americans, but for all Americans. And what I hear when I see Senator Harris stepping to the podium, taking the microphone, is a candidate and now a vice president-elect who is speaking to all Americans, who is speaking to our highest ideals. And those are the interests not only of Black women, those are the interests of everyone.
I would love both of you to weigh in on this. Martha, I'll start with you, and then Kimberly, I'd love your thoughts here, because Kamala Harris, we've been talking about this since she was a candidate for president and then Joe Biden's running mate, but she has made history here as the first woman, the first Black woman, the first South Asian woman ever elected vice president in our nation's history. Also the daughter of immigrants. What will it mean to have someone like Kamala Harris in the White House, Martha?
You know, on the one hand, I think it's important to say that, in my view, dubbing her a first is in some ways faint praise. I think we should respect her for her singular accomplishments. But I think the most important effect of her election is the sign that Black women have become a force in American politics. No longer are we simply breaking barriers or becoming first, but we are really consolidating power at the highest level. Senator Harris ran alongside 130 Black women who were vying for seats in Congress in 2020. And this is a new day in American politics, where no longer is she a token. She is someone who really has the capacity now to govern, to legislate alongside other Black women, and to steer the national agenda in many of the ways that Kimberly has outlined for us. of course, I am someone, like many of us, so deeply moved by the images of our daughters and our granddaughters meeting, looking up to, watching the television as Kamala Harris takes the podium. And this representation will mean a great deal for the ambition of Black girls, young Black women going forward in the next cycles and in the next generations. But make no mistake, more than a force, more than a first, she is part of a force.
Kimberly, your thoughts on that, on what Kamala Harris, what it will mean to have someone like Kamala Harris in the White House, and also what does she symbolize, sort of picking up on what Martha was just saying about the future of Black women in politics?
Yeah, I absolutely echo everything that Martha said, and I think it really is a great opportunity to bring diverse voices, a diverse life experience to the highest decision-making table. And I think that's one of the things that is just so exciting and inspiring, in addition to seeing someone that looks like me, that looks like my daughter, but also to know that she will be bringing so much more that has never been part of this conversation. And it really shows the possibilities that exist. And we are continuing to expand Black women's elected leadership in this country, not just at the top of the ticket, but we are continuing to grow the number of Black women in Congress. There's still several seats that that are to be decided with the record vote count, but it looks like we have added three more Black women to the halls of Congress. There are so many firsts that are happening at the state legislative level, and it just shows that Black women are definitely a force, and we have something tremendous to contribute to the conversation, that the electorate sees value in those contributions and sees the opportunity to add more voices, different conversations, and more issues to the national discourse.
Martha, when we talk about Black women and political activism, we can't ignore the fact that Black Lives Matter was founded by three Black women. That is also something can you tell us a little bit about the historical engagement of Black women in terms of organizing movements like that, organizing to get the vote, organizing to bring attention to issues that affect not just Black women, but Black people more broadly?
We can't miss in this moment, even as Senator Harris is the vice president-elect, that what undergirds that is Black women's organizing. Just tune in to Alicia Garza and appreciate her message, right, which is yes to the streets and yes to the ballot box. And what we saw in this election season was the wedding of those two approaches to American politics.
Is that something that's, you would say, has gotten stronger, not just taking it to the streets, but actually taking it to the ballot box? Was that the missing link in terms of engagement, particularly for Black women, Black people in this country?
That has always been true for us, but I think that in this season, that became apparent in the sort of compressed circumstances of coronavirus, a summer of Black Lives Matter uprisings across the country, with this extraordinarily consequential election. We all got a lesson in African American politics, I think, this season, by seeing it compressed under extraordinary circumstances. Those facets that have always been there, and we saw them come together vividly.
Black women, Asian, white, Latina, Native American women, who throughout our nation's history have paved the way for this moment tonight. Women who fought and sacrificed so much for equality and liberty and justice for all, including the Black women who are often too often overlooked, but so often prove they are the backbone of our democracy.
Kimberly, we just heard Kamala Harris say that black women cannot be overlooked anymore. Joe Biden in his speech essentially over the weekend said that he recognized the power of black voters. Are black women going to finally get their due from this administration?
That is the hope. I think we're really hoping to finally get the return on our political investment, that we will, our issues will have a voice and have a place in this administration. And as much as we fought to support and get the ticket to this place, we will definitely be holding it accountable and looking at many of the policies that the president-elect laid out in his victory speech on Saturday night, that that he actually puts a lot of policy and meat behind them. But I think this is a huge step forward. The fact that things like systemic racism and healthcare are, you know, front and center in his mind, and absolutely in the vice president-elect's mind as well. I think there's a huge potential for a tremendous amount of progress, but we will definitely be doing as much as we can to help advance that and also hold them accountable.
Martha, there's to your point about, you know, making a lot about being the first often also means being the only. And there will be an enormous amount of pressure, not just on Joe Biden, but also on Kamala Harris, being in that role. She received a lot of criticism before earning her spot as vice president in terms of how she dealt with criminal justice issues when she was Attorney General of California. So the pressure that she is under is, I think, in many ways unimaginable, to have to sort of satisfy the demands of a very progressive constituency that essentially voted her into office.
I don't think Senator Harris is new to that sort of pressure. As you've mentioned, you know, she's already been subject to that kind of scrutiny, as she herself was part of this primary contest that led up to her nomination. So in one sense, I think she's someone who is frankly very tested when it comes to that sort of scrutiny, that sort of pressure. On the other hand, the pressure I'm interested in is what it is like for not only leaders in this country, but leaders across the globe to come to the table in Washington and sit across from now Vice President Harris to contend with a black woman world leader, not only to understand her history, but to understand her position, her ideas, and frankly, to understand her culture. You know, one of the things that we've commented on is everything from Senator Harris rocking, you know, Tim's and Chuck's on the tarmac to the side eye during debates. I think there's a new page in the handbook of world diplomacy, and it will be one devoted to understanding how black women come culturally to the table in American and world politics.
Kimberly, we saw an unprecedented number of black women running in down ballot races. What did that look like in terms of our congressional makeup?
Well, it looked like a wave that began in 2018, where we saw a record number of black women running for Congress up and down the ballot. To double that number, it was just over 160 black women started out the primary, and I think just about half of those women made it onto the general ballot. And you know, we now see three, and we're waiting to see what happens with Lauren Underwood's race in Illinois, but it looks like she is up in the polls, so she will be going back to Congress. So it definitely continues to grow the number of black women. We are slowly creeping up to almost 5% of the members of Congress. Black women are 7% of the U.S. population, so there's still a lot of work to be done. But it shows that black women see their power, they see the possibility of their leadership, they see the value in their leadership, and they also see that now there's no reason to wait. They have something to contribute. there is a pathway, not just to the halls of Congress or to the Senate, but also a pathway to the vice presidency through Stacey Abrams' race in 2018. There is a pathway to the governorship and how to get over that final finish line. So I think we are going to continue to see the number of Black women who stand for office up and down the ballot continue to grow. And we're going to continue to see them not just run, but actually win and lead.
I think about John Lewis, and I think about him being the conscience of Congress, and why Black people have to bear this weight, and wonder how we can take some of that weight off of Black women to have to be, you know, this deciding factor every time an election comes around. Or maybe it's not a weight. I don't know. I mean,
I think it is a burden. It is not an enviable burden, I think, to be the conscience of this nation season after season. It is not an enviable burden to be holding up fundamental pillars of this democracy, like voting rights, season after season. At the same time, someone has to do that work, it seems, in our democracy. Thank goodness that Black women have been willing and able to step into that role and to be our conscience, but also to do the work on the ground to make good on our best ideals. I think that if there's one thing we could do, it might be, for example, to use these years to finally dispense with voter suppression, right? Part of the effort that Black women have to make is because we're not only doing the work of getting folks registered, getting to the ballot box, getting those ballots counted, we're doing that in the face of a still rising tide of voter suppression across this country, whether it's shuttered polling places or it's 4-hour long lines or it's voter ID requirements or exact match obligations. This is the heavy lifting is in part structural, and we have an opportunity here going forward out of this election to restore the Voting Rights Act and to take down the kinds of barriers that Black women are having to hurdle themselves over in order to do the fundamental work of democracy.
One thing that we'll be talking about later in the show today is about Joe Biden's promise in his speech over the weekend to try to create some sort of unity, to not look at the other side, quote unquote, as enemies, but instead as Americans. And I think that that's going to be a very tall order. I think that if he attempts to do that, he will... while it sounds good, he's going to run into some difficulties. This is an extraordinarily divided country. We saw that in the election results. We saw that folks that are very progressive are going to hold Biden, the Harris-Biden ticket, their feet to the fire. And, you know, they've lost 70 million Americans who are not interested in seeing this administration. Will this incoming administration be able to create unity while at the same time fostering and moving forth goals that support Black people and specifically Black women?
Biden and the Democrats are at a crossroads, which is to say one way forward is indeed a kind of concession or an appeasement to the 70 million plus Americans who supported the Republicans and President Trump. The other way forward is to build a new kind of democracy, and that is one that certainly will include Black American women. And Senator Harris, I think we know now, Vice President-elect Harris will make sure of that. But let's remember, Latino voters, Native American women voters, Asian American women voters also disproportionately supported Vice President Biden and Senator Harris during their contest. And this is an opportunity to build a new Democratic Party that is inclusive of those stalwarts of this party, along with the many, many young people, it turns out, turned out for this election disproportionately. I don't know that both things are possible, even as both things are true. And so we are at a crossroads, I think, and the question of what this nation looks like, what its values are real thorny questions, as you suggest, not questions that can be easily resolved or papered over.
Kimberly Peeler Allen is a visiting practitioner at the Rutgers University Center for American Women in Politics. And Martha Jones is a professor of history at the Johns Hopkins University and author of Vanguard, How Black Women Broke Barriers, Won the Vote, and Insisted on Equality for All. Kimberly and Martha, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The archives at Carnegie Hall hold treasures from our cultural history. In the new podcast, If This Hall Could Talk, we use these items as touchstones to explore how the past shaped the world we live in today. I'm your host, Jessica Vosk, and I'll be joined by historians, performers, cultural critics, and others to look back at the iconic venue's legendary and sometimes quirky history. If This Hall Could Talk, from Carnegie Hall and distributed by WQXR. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
President Trump has yet to concede the election, but the Trump campaign has already announced a number of legal challenges to the results in states like Pennsylvania, Georgia, Michigan, Arizona, Nevada, and North Carolina. But the big question is whether these are a last-ditch effort by the president to remain relevant or whether they actually have legal merit. And that's what my next guest and I are going to discuss. Mark Joseph Stern is a staff writer for Slate, and he covers the courts and the law. Mark, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me back on.
So judges in Georgia, Michigan, and Nevada have already dismissed lawsuits filed by the Trump campaign. What were the legal grounds that judges had for dismissing those lawsuits?
So most of these lawsuits are really about process, not about substance. So the Trump campaign has repeatedly argued across several states that legal observers, specifically Republican legal observers, were not allowed to witness the ballot tabulation process closely enough, that they couldn't get close enough to make sure there was no funny business going on. That doesn't seem to be true. These seem to be fabricated claims designed to kind of throw a wrench in the vote tallying process, rather than winning any extra votes for Trump. And the reason judges have thrown them out is because they don't have much merits. The Trump campaign can say whatever it wants on Twitter, but when it gets into court and its lawyers are under oath, they have to speak the truth. And the truth is, there just isn't any mischief going on behind the scenes in any of these states.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Pennsylvania, because they had been dealing with some legal issues even before the election started. Where does that stand now, Mark?
Yeah, so the Pennsylvania case is the strongest one for the Trump campaign by far. So Pennsylvania law says that all ballots have to be received by November 3rd, but the Pennsylvania Supreme Court extended the grace period to November 6th for ballots that were mailed by Election Day. The Trump campaign has fought that very hard, and four Supreme Court justices have already said that they would basically like to throw out those ballots. So the Trump campaign has been sort of reminding the Supreme Court, hey, we've got these late ballots. The counties are segregating them and not including them in the vote count. So, you know, they have not contributed to Joe Biden's victory there so far. But right now, it doesn't look like there are nearly enough of these late arriving ballots to change the outcome of the election and to make any of this litigation worth it. It's in the thousands, perhaps, while Joe Biden's lead is in the tens of thousands. And so even if the Supreme Court came in and said, we've got to throw out every ballot that arrived in Pennsylvania after November 3rd, it would not give Trump that state and it would not change the outcome of this election.
Another state that the Trump campaign has its eyes on is Wisconsin. They've already said that they would ask for a recount there. Where does that stand? And will they be asking for a recount in any other states?
So it looks like there will be a recount in Wisconsin, but the reality is that recounts usually only change a few hundred votes at most. If you have a super thin margin, you know, a few dozen or a few hundred votes separating the winner and the loser, then a recount can be a nail biter. But right now, Biden is ahead 20,000 votes. It doesn't look like it's going to change anything. You know, after Jill Stein paid for a recount in 2016, Donald Trump ended up getting a few more hundred votes than the initial count had found. So that will happen, but it probably won't change anything. I believe the Trump campaign will seek a recount in Georgia as well, possibly Arizona and Nevada, though it's too soon to tell. But again, as thin as those margins are, we're talking in the thousands or tens of thousands, not in the hundreds. So they don't seem likely to change anything.
It feels like there isn't a lot of merit to a lot of these lawsuits. We've said some of them have already been tossed out. I mean, this is really an attempt at what? The president is trying to stay in the conversation. He's trying to delegitimize the election. I mean, pretty much, I mean, the Biden campaign is moving forward with its transition. So what is the point of all this?
So I think there are two goals here on Trump's side. The first goal is to sow doubt and distrust in the legitimacy of this election and its results, right? Donald Trump has said pretty clearly he does not plan on conceding. And this gives him an off-ramp. He can say, okay, well, I'll leave the White House on January 20th if you make me. But, you know, I don't believe that I really lost this election. I think if it had been a free and fair election, that I would have won and that you guys were up to some mischief that stole it from me. Not true at all, but that's pretty clearly what he plans to say. I think the second goal here is a more typical standard Republican play, which is to lay the groundwork for voter suppression laws in the future, right? Over the last 20 years or so, the Republican Party has committed itself to a slate of laws that make it much more difficult to vote. Things like draconian voter ID requirements, cuts to early voting, and they've done all of this in the name of preventing voter fraud. I think after this election wraps up, when Trump is out of the White House, whether he's dragged out or leaves freely, Republicans in a lot of these states are going to go back and say, hey, we believe the president. We believe that there was fraud. And in order to stop this fraud from continuing, we're going to have to crack down on voting, make it more difficult in ways that almost always disproportionately affect racial minorities and low-income people, of course, people who do not traditionally support the Republican Party.
Now, of course, right before the election, or at least the Joe Biden won the Electoral College votes needed to become president, there were a number of Supreme Court decisions about really essentially giving and leaving power in terms of the voting process in the hands of the states, Mark. Do you see that changing?
No, not at all. And in fact, the Supreme Court's conservatives have been pretty strident in the last few months about leaving the rules of an election entirely in the hands of a state legislature, saying this is no place for the federal courts to step in and meddle with the rules. And some of the very far-right conservatives have even said this is no place for state courts to step in. In fact, the state legislature has total control over this process. If the legislature wants to make it really difficult to vote, that is its constitutional prerogative. So with this new 6-3 conservative majority, I really doubt that the Supreme Court will ever strike down a voter suppression law. It seems like the states have free rein now and for the foreseeable future to make voting more difficult, and we will see the results of that over the next couple of years in the elections to come.
Speaking of making voting more difficult, one of the reasons, at least many people are saying, that Georgia flipped for Joe Biden was because Stacey Abrams and her coalition of folks down there wanted to make voting more accessible. Are you seeing more of that? Will this inspire more movement on that front? People like Stacey Abrams to make the process much more accessible for voters?
Absolutely. This has become a chief Democratic priority, and it seems to really excite the base and Democratic voters. They love this idea of pushing back against voter suppression, standing up for democracy with a small d, right? Saying this is not a partisan issue. Everyone should be able to exercise the franchise if they so choose. And so I think we will see more people like Stacey Abrams in other states that are just now turning purple saying, hey, let's make it easier for people to vote. Let's make sure everybody has a voice in their elections, and pitching that, again, not as a political question, but as a way to bring America further into the 21st century and to make it more of an open democracy where everybody has a say.
Mark Joseph Stern is a staff writer for Slate covering courts and the law. Mark, thanks for being with me.
Thanks so much. Always a pleasure.
On Saturday night, President-elect Joe Biden delivered a message that he's put at the center of his entire campaign.
And to make progress, we have to stop treating our opponents as our enemies. They are not our enemies. They are Americans. They are Americans. The Bible tells us, to everything there is a season, a time to build, a time to reap, and a time to sow, and a time to heal. This is the time to heal in America.
But once Biden is actually sworn in, achieving that unity will be no small task. 70 million people still voted for Donald Trump in an election that Democrats were hoping would be a referendum on Trumpism. And while Joe Biden has routinely emphasized his plans for a strong COVID-19 response as one way to get the country back on track, the pandemic has already been deeply politicized by President Trump and his allies. Polling by Pew Research from October found that while 82% of Biden supporters said COVID-19 was very important to their vote, just 24% of Trump supporters said the same. For more on the ideological divide that Joe Biden is about to wade into, I'm joined by Camille Rivera, partner at New Deal Strategies, a progressive consulting firm. Camille, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Doug High, who has held communications positions in the House, Senate, RNC, and served in the George W. Bush administration. Welcome back to The Takeaway, Doug.
It's great to be with you.
Camille, let's start with you. Joe Biden gave a big, lofty speech where he called for unity, emphasized that conservatives aren't the enemies of the left. But did that resonate with progressives?
I think that it was a wonderful speech. And the reason I think is that he definitely understood that this was a collaborative effort to defeat Donald Trump. He was very clear early on when he received the nomination that he was going to create an opportunity for progressives to put the important issues out there, issues related to economic justice, healthcare, issues related to what's really happening around COVID and COVID relief. I think it was quite clear that he created a mandate that will allow him to bring everybody together. The challenge is going to be moving those issues forward pretty quickly. And I think you've seen that in the last 24 hours where he is already starting to move on a lot of these specific agendas.
Doug, what do you think of Biden's message? Did it resonate with conservatives and the 70 some odd million Trump supporters who voted for the president?
Well, I thought it was one of the best speeches Joe Biden's ever given. And it didn't resonate with conservatives, mostly because they probably weren't tuning in. And that's not Joe Biden's fault, but that's part of the difficulty that he's going to have moving forward. The good news, I think, for Biden and for the country is that he is uniquely positioned as opposed to anyone else who is running on the Democratic side or, frankly, any other Republican to be that person to heal the country, to help bridge divides. You know, my first job in politics was for Jesse Helms. What Democrat did he work with most closely? Joe Biden. My last job on Capitol Hill was for Eric Cantor. The Democrat he worked most closely with was Joe Biden. Biden instinctively knows how to bridge divides and to work for bipartisan solutions. But it's a challenge to get big things done in Washington these days. And it's a challenge to, you know, bridge those divides that we say we want to heal. But then actually, you know, building that bridge is difficult. And I think Biden's going to try and do the right thing, but also struggle.
Doug, one thing I do have to bring up is that you mentioned that you had started working with Senator Jesse Helms. Joe Biden got a lot of criticism early in his campaign for talking about how he was able to compromise with Jesse Helms, who was an advocate for segregation. What do you say to those on the left who say the goal shouldn't be to return to a period of compromise with people like Helms who supported segregation?
Sure. Look, obviously, they were not working together on issues like that, and nor was I. But what they worked on was issues at the Foreign Relations Committee. And where you have opportunities to work with people of different parties and different beliefs, that's how you get things done. You know, I saw earlier this year, Ted Cruz signed on with an AOC issue. And those are the strangest political bedfellows you could ever think. But if they agree on something, well, then I think we can all agree on things. We're not going to agree on everything, but where we can, you can and should do that.
I want to press both of you on that, because I think, you know, Doug, what you're describing is a time before Trumpism. Trumpism has really changed the electorate in many ways. It's changed what the Republican Party looks like. And so I'm wondering, Doug, are there specific policies that the Biden administration is going to have to compromise with congressional Republicans on? And Camille, I'm going to ask you the same question about progressives, where they may have to compromise.
I think it's pretty clear that across the country, there was a mandate where the country was pretty over the rhetoric and really wanted to be focused on the issues that matter. In Florida, despite Trump's win, there was a $15 minimum wage, a very important issue. That is, as a state that, you know, was blue and now has flipped back and forth and now is pretty much in the red, but still are very important issues. And I think you'll find that conservatives, Democrats, Republicans, whoever, independents, really want to just have a better life. And I don't necessarily believe that progressives are going to have to compromise on issues that Americans care about. I mean, it's quite clear that most of the country wants stability on healthcare. They want to make sure that they can get out of this COVID crisis. And I'm actually, it's actually really something to be seen that places like Mississippi that voted for a medical marijuana program, places in suburbs of Detroit that elected a new county prosecutor, you know, paid family leave in Colorado, you know, increased taxes on the rich to pay for public education in Arizona. I think Democrats have to pretty much understand that progressives are not the boogeyman, that it's actually quite clear that these are about issues and that the rhetoric has to change, but the ideas don't.
Doug, what are your thoughts on that? Because, again, bringing up, we got about a minute left in this part of the conversation, but this Washington is not the Washington of our yesteryear. I mean, we are in a moment where still 70 million Americans voted for President Trump.
Yeah, and look, I think it depends on what you start with. And so if Joe Biden is to start with, say, something like a COVID relief package, obviously that's something that could get bipartisan support, or infrastructure, that can get bipartisan support. And that's where his ability to negotiate with Congress would benefit him, and starts on a good foot. What happens after that? Well, that's where we're going to have disagreements and fight in a normal sense, not the abnormal sense that we've done over the past few years.
Camille, the squad was reelected, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, and her group of uber progressive Democrats. They had a rocky relationship with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and more centrist Democrats. Is Joe Biden going to have to learn how to navigate that?
I mean, I think he worked very hard, and I think the AOC and the squad worked very hard to elect Joe Biden. If you saw that, there is a stark difference between what happened in 2016 when Hillary Clinton was nominated versus when Joe Biden. I think everyone had a common goal here, and it was to defeat Donald Trump. I think it's okay for there to be a back and forth between left Congress members who are very much in touch with what's happening in this country, and poke the bear a little bit, or poke them with a stick, to make sure that people are listening to the issues that matter. I think we can't forget, and we cannot marginalize, the people of color, especially women who powered Biden into office. It was a historic turnout driven by grassroots organizing in places like Detroit, Minneapolis, Atlanta, Phoenix, and in places in the counties in Pennsylvania, where we're now seeing all the numbers come back for Biden.
But we do know, Camille, that Joe Biden was not the choice for progressives. They were not thrilled that Joe Biden ended up getting the nomination.
Right. It's called the Democratic primary. And I think, obviously, there is always going to be concerns about the president-elect moving on these important issues. I think it's going to be very important that we all hold each other accountable. And I think that is the role of these elected officials, in particularly in Congress. Also, it's very important to understand that they represent a very important base of people that actually did propel him as well to office. And I think people keep thinking about the fact that, oh, this one person is responsible for the election, this one person actually delivered. But to be quite honest, this was a collaborative effort. And all Joe Biden needs to do is actually listen to what's happening on the ground. These issues out there that people are saying are the most progressive and to the left and are not going to be something that centrist Democrats want to hear about, it's not necessarily any different than what's happening in New York or within the rest of the country. Everyone is facing a COVID crisis. Everyone is facing economic injustice. Racism is rampant in this country. And we want stability. Now, that doesn't mean there can't be back and forth debate about the issues. Now, do I believe that we're going to have to do some real organizing and work? I think you'll see progressives not make the same mistakes they made when Obama was elected, which is making sure that we have these issues, you know, coming forward, in particularly on issues related to immigration and unifying families.
I want to bring Doug back in here. Doug, the speech that Joe Biden gave essentially, in many ways, asks people in the Democratic Party, people perhaps on the left, to empathize with Trump supporters. And empathy is something we talk a lot about on this show. It's one of the core tenets of the show, or the lack thereof. Donald Trump was not an empathetic candidate. He did not run an empathetic campaign. Is there a double standard when it comes to asking people on the left to empathize with those on the right?
Maybe, but that also means standing up and being the bigger person. And you know, that's ultimately in this country, I think, where we need to be. And let's differentiate between the Trump voter and the person who flies the Trump flag that also says F your feelings, right? That's a very different mindset. Most of the Trump voters, the overwhelming majority of Trump voters, might not have loved his tweets, might not have loved his rhetoric, but they were angry at government shutdowns that we saw, you know, in city after city and states. They thought that he might have the best economic policies to move forward as we get out of this. They were responding to something different. And you know, a lot of Democrats will just think, well, Trump is awful and therefore all of his voters are awful. It's not all of his voters, right? There are some deplorable people, to use Hillary Clinton's word. And we can be mindful of that while also trying to figure out how do we effectively solve the problems that face us? What are their concerns and how do we address them? And that's where we should all be able to unite on. One of the biggest issues that affects so many Trump voters is the issue of fentanyl and heroin. This is what Dave Chappelle talked about Saturday night. Well, that's not a red issue or a blue issue. It's an issue that we should solve. And when we can do that, that's how we work together. And not to be Pollyannish about this, but where we can solve the problems that we agree are problems, that's what we should do. And that, to me, is the mandate that Biden has.
And you both agree that Biden has a mandate. I mean, I'm curious, there's other issues, Camille, where Joe Biden has not aligned with racial justice activists, for example, on defunding the police. What fight does he face there?
I mean, I think it is going to be a very important conversation. We cannot deny the fact that there is a substantial imbalance and has been around policing in this country. And it is quite clear that we have to do something about that. And I would say that whether or not people like the term defund the police, whether it's, you know, reforming criminal justice and making sure that most of the funding that's going into police actually go into education and healthcare and issues that are very, very important, I think is going to be a very important question. Also understanding that you can have community safety without stepping on the necks of Black and brown communities. And I do believe that will be a point of contention, but I do also believe that the president-elect understands this.
I hear the point. I also just want to make sure we get one more question into Doug here. The Senate hangs in the balance, Doug. There are runoff races happening in Georgia, but until we have the answer there, the Senate leadership is essentially could continue to be Republican. Will that afford Joe Biden the opportunity to do anything of this unifying if it does not swing Democrat?
Well, it means it's a hard task. And look, I think, you know, we both have used the word, or all three of us, the word mandate. You know, to me, the biggest mandate that Joe Biden has is to try and figure out how to help us heal. He has a mandate of competency. Right. I don't think it's so much about this issue or that issue, but how we approach things. And Biden, again, I would say, is uniquely positioned to do that. It doesn't mean that Mitch McConnell is going to say, oh, my God, this is great. We're going to be able to work on so much together. There are real divides. There are real disagreements. And what I hope is that we can get to, I used the phrase earlier, the normal fights that we used to have. And this predates Trump. You know, we saw this in the rise of the House Freedom Caucus and government shutdowns and things like that, where Republicans were fighting amongst themselves, so we couldn't even get in a position to fight with Democrats. And ultimately, I think one of the things we've learned in the past 10 years is that in Washington right now, you only get the big things done when you have one-party rule. Obamacare only could have passed with the Democratic House and Senate. The tax bill only could have passed with the Republican House and Senate. So we're not going to see these huge legislative deals from Biden, but we can see infrastructure. We can see a good COVID relief package. And again, I would say, I think the mandate that Biden has is one of trying to bridge divides, one of competency, which is something that's been lacking from Washington. But also, we should be clear, there are divides within the Democratic Party. There was the phone call with House Democrats this week where Abigail Spanberger said, look, this is why I nearly lost. Defund the police is one of those things. And I'm reminded of, in hearing that debate that they have, in where the House of Representatives was in 2012, 13, 14, with the rise of the Freedom Caucus. And, you know, the Squad is a real force. We can't deny that. But they could represent a kind of House Democratic Freedom Caucus that stymies Democrats from getting to 218 votes in the House of Representatives. It's something I struggled with almost every day when I worked for Eric Cantor in the House of Representatives.
Camille, your thoughts on that, because, again, if the Senate is led by Republicans, it's going to be, I think, a very difficult battle for Joe Biden to achieve some of the goals that he's set out, whether they're centrist or progressive or otherwise.
Yeah, I mean, there is no doubt in my mind that there is going to be a lot of fighting. I think there is going to be a lot of back and forth within, and particularly with McConnell. He is not going to change his ideas or rhetoric. I do believe somewhere in his, I think he does believe probably in deep down that a Trump administration was extremely volatile for the country. That being said, that's not going to change his positions. He stood by when families were being teared apart. He stood by during the COVID relief efforts and pushed back a lot of the proposals that came aboard. And he also, approved Amy Coney Barrett for Supreme Court justice. So, and I also want to just also pivot back to the idea that the only thing I disagreed with Doug on is the ease of normalcy of fighting. I think there was always a lot of vitriol and back and forth. The issues are pretty much going to be the same. I think you're going to see, hopefully, is a temperature that will be a little bit lower. You're going to see the president really try to reach, to all Democrats within the party, to let them know that these issues are going to be important. I also believe that we're going to have more in common than what we think. Maybe that's just me being a little bit optimistic. But the issues around the COVID relief, there's so many things that we can do there. We can raise the minimum wage. We can raise taxes for on the rich. We can do a lot of different things that I think, or at least have that debate and discussion that I believe the Squad could actually bring forth. I want to be very clear, right? We have a real mandate for unity in this country, a real mandate. Does that mean that everybody's going to agree?
I actually want to push back on both of you say that there's a mandate. I don't sense that there is a mandate. I think many Americans, at least the Democrats, are surprised that there weren't more folks voting for Joe Biden, given what many people experienced in the past 4 years. So, I mean, we could definitely go back and forth on what constitutes a mandate. But I think that the turnout for President Trump was significant. And I think it's hard to ignore what the past 4 years under this president have really done to the GOP, have done to the country, have done to the tone and tenor of what's happening in Washington, D.C. And I just think it's going to be a harder fight than perhaps maybe I'm not as optimistic as both of you, perhaps.
Yeah, I'd agree. And you know, there was a line, I think it was a Karl Rove line after Bush won in 2000, where he said, okay, well, we don't have a mandate, but we have the presidency. And that's ultimately what's important here is Joe Biden's got the presidency. It's the biggest platform in the world and will allow him to do things or try and do things differently than the past 4 years. And you're right. You know, we're not going to have this moment where, you know, Americans just hold hands and say, well, everything's great now, because everything's not great and everybody doesn't agree on things. But where Biden can be the person that he's always been to try and work together on issues. And again, what you start with really determines things. If Donald Trump had started with an infrastructure deal, you know, we might have had a different conversation over the past 4 years. So we'll have to see what Biden does. But we can also be happy that we know that we're going to, because the phrase was used earlier, lower the temperature. And if we break our fever, well, that's already a good thing.
Doug High, communications specialist for the House, Senate, RNC, and George W. Bush administration, and Camille Rivera, partner at New Deal Strategies. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's it for us today. And we're ending on a sad note, mourning the loss of Alex Trebek, longtime host of Jeopardy. Trebek died of pancreatic cancer this weekend at the age of 80. And as a host myself, I can only dream about being as sharp, knowledgeable, and as kind as he was. He was a legend of the genre and a voice we will never forget. If you missed anything or you want to listen back again to today's show, you can check out our podcast at thetakeaway.org. And of course, you can call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and we'll see you tomorrow.